When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. What a day I had yesterday in Washington, D.C. Again, another one of those moments where, you know, I get to do kind of fun things with this. We held an event with Sarah Nelson, the president of the AFA-CWA, the Flight Attendants Union, and also with Ohio Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur. And it was, you know, one of these wonderful moments of, you know, just being able to talk about the things that are important, you know, moving the country forward, how we're going to rebuild a prosperous working class. There's so much, you know, how we were going to message. Oh, just an incredible opportunity to get in a room full of like-minded folks and say, hey, how are we gonna go forward? And look, point at the Republican Party, who has been, well, less than useful, to be quite frank, less than useful. And this is one of these moments. I look at today, the news was all about Hunter Biden. The news was all about non-human biological pilots from crashed crafts. Yes. The UFO whistleblower took all of the, so, you know, my congressman got all into this because we got to get to the bottom of it. Americans have every right to know the full scope of UAPs, UFOs. The claims today, while sensible, while sensational, have come from very credible witnesses. Scott Perry, my congressman, says, all with military experience and high security clearances, we need and deserve to know what we're dealing with. And look, this is all fun. This is all good. It's all games. Look, you know, are there Martians or are aliens flying around? I don't know. Here's what I do know. I do know working people are struggling to make ends meet. I do know people are still struggling to put food on the table. I do get that. So the sideshow that, you know, has become the Republican governance in the House, yeah, I guess this is much better than actually doing your job. It's much easier to play, you know, midnight talk host than it is to actually have a plan, which, by the way, the guy sitting in the White House seems to be doing a pretty good job. You've got, you know, Jelly Bucket Joe out there doing the work. He tweeted out today, by investing in American manufacturing, we're seeing the rebirth of pride that comes from stamping products made in the U.S. And by the way, those jobs, you know, the jobs that, you know, Republicans love to talk about creating. Biden also points out that right now we have the lowest inflation rate among the G7. Wages are growing faster than inflation, job satisfaction at a 36-year high, and the share of working-age Americans in the workforce is the highest it's been in 20 years. It's no accident. It's my plan. And look, I agree with him. It is the plan. It's what we've been saying on this show for years. We need to be investing in infrastructure. We need to be reshoring manufacturing. This is not new and should not be news to anyone. And when you have lower inflation rates, when you have lower unemployment, you have workers who start going, hey, wait a second. Those profits, we'd like some. You know, all those profits that we create, we'd like some. Which is why, you know, looking at the Teamsters agreement with UPS, while, you know, I've had some people go, well, it's not enough, is historic. I mean, the fact that they got rid of a two-tier wage system is huge. The fact that, you know, the raises that they've got look pretty good from the outside. It'll be interesting to see what the membership does. This could be a moment because the responses I've got are, no, we want better. This could be a John Deere moment where the membership says it's not enough. And that comes from having the ability to say, you know what? We're worth something. Now, what's interesting is I happened to see that Jim Cramer guy on CNBC, the guy who makes all the noises and, you know, hit stuff and all that. He was talking about the Teamster UPS deal, and he goes, well, it looks like the Teamsters got the best of UPS. And they then went in to talk about Ford and the concern he had for the automakers, because he really truly cares about the automakers. And he said something that caught my attention. He said that the UAW, the United Auto Workers, and their new president, Sean Fain, what was the quote that he used? Are more like the 1930s UAW, which we don't want. And my question went, you know, what we are we talking about? Because I do want the kind of militancy that built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. Yes, bring me some of those 1930s union members, some of those people who were willing to have sit down strikes, some of those people who were willing to get out in the streets and shut things down. Give me those folks. Because here's the thing. And this is the important part of this. While I'm looking at Biden and I'm saying, you know, policy-wise, moving in the right direction, doing smart stuff, thrilled with that, a lot of people are still struggling. Workers are still not getting the wages, the benefits, the conditions that they earn. The share of wealth being created by every hour of working people's efforts, not being shared. And that comes back to not having the kind of bargaining power that the Teamsters had at UPS. That doesn't translate across all industries. And for me, this is where I keep going. We're in a moment. And they keep talking about hot labor summer. Yeah, there's a lot of people saying enough is enough. And that is a good thing. It's something we should want. Especially now that we're seeing reports that inflation's coming down. Wages are actually up. And this is a good thing. Now, what Republicans are doing, interestingly enough, and you knew this was coming, because they can't attack Biden anymore on, you know, inflation's too high. That's that the, you know, gas is, you know, $16 a gallon and eggs are a gazillion dollars. They can't do that anymore. They can't tout their policies because they don't have anything. They're talking about UFOs. That's the best they've got, UFOs. You know your party is devoid of any ideas when we got to look into UFOs. When there are literally kids going to bed hungry in this country, we got veterans on the streets, we've got problems and a broken government that refuses to address it. And this is why, again, you know, you may think, well, the Democrats are terrible. Look, they're trying, man. The reality is they've got policies that they're moving forward on. They got ideas on how we're going to reunionize, regrow, reunite this country. For instance, Bernie Sanders and Bobby Scott, the congressman from Virginia, senator from Vermont, congressman from Virginia, they've come forth with the Raise the Wage Act. It's back again. And now not just 15, they want $17 an hour. And the right is losing their mind. My inbox full of all of the right-wing think tanks telling me, it's the end of humanity. We're going to lose, you know, here in Pennsylvania where I live, 130,000 jobs across the country, you know, what, some 500,000. We're going to lose jobs. Like, they care. That's the part that gets me. Because these, well, they probably do, because these are the jobs that they say are, you know, the restaurant jobs, the cleaning up after rich people jobs, you know, the low wage jobs that, you know, mostly women and people of color do. Yeah, we can't help them. Now, understand, they don't care about the $17 an hour at the bottom. As I've said before, they care about that ripple upward, that money that's going to, you know, every working person who's making 15, 16, 17, 18 bucks an hour are going to go, hey, if the minimum wage is now from 7.25 to 17, we want a bump. That's what they're afraid of. That means profits are going to have to go down a little bit, and they're going to have to share. And they don't like sharing, not even a little bit, which is why, again, the Jim Cramers of the world, the right-wing think tanks of the world are all going, be afraid of these wage increases. Be afraid of these unions. These unions, they're bad. Because heaven forbid we have a labor movement like the 1930s that evolved into the movement of the 40s, 50s, and 60s that saw the broadest shared prosperity across the board. Heaven forbid we do that. And heaven forbid you have workers who have the kind of economic power that allows them to have some political power that would say, hey, maybe we raise taxes on rich people. And oh, by the way, the Oligarch Act is something we're going to talk about today. So I got a lot to get to. I want to take your calls. We're going to take a quick break right back after that. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, I remember when I was a kid. They used to play that game Hot Lava. You remember that when you were a kid? Where you couldn't step on the ground. You had to, like, step on rocks or something. Because, hey, the lava was flowing. I saw a story over at CNN. Caught my attention. Evidently, in Arizona, as we speak, it's so hot that doctors are treating patients who are burned, literally burned, because they fell on the ground. They just fell. And by the time they got back up, burns. It's not fun anymore. It's not funny, I don't think. Anyway, let's go to the phones. We got Michael in Chicago on line one. Michael, how are you? We got you there, Michael?
Well, pretty good. Could you hear me?
Yeah, listen to the phone, not to your radio.
Yeah, I like to talk about ranked choice voting.
Uh-huh. What's on your mind?
Now, I think ranked choice voting is a better way to vote.
Okay.
In traditional voting, you only get one vote, one little tiny vote, even though six or seven or eight people are running for a district. You only get one vote. In ranked choice voting, you get five votes, five good votes. Your first place vote, second place vote, and so forth. And you have a better chance to influence the election. Now, in ranked choice voting, there's no need for an expensive runoff election. That's not necessary. One election will do the job. Now, many people will use their first choice vote as a protest vote or to vote for a third party candidate, or vote for their own identity, their own racial or ethnic identity. And that's okay. But then you have your second and third place vote, and that would be for a candidate with a more broader appeal. So you could do both things with ranked choice voting. You could do a protest vote, get that out of the way, and then you could vote for Biden, the more moderate candidate, who probably will win. Now, ranked choice voting is real good. It's coming to many cities now. I want to just list a few of the big cities that have ranked choice voting and are successful in using it. San Francisco, Oakland, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. And Seattle, Washington voted on it and got it approved. Portland, Oregon, and Salt Lake City. Now, I live in Chicago, Illinois. The only jurisdiction we have that approved it is Evanston, Illinois, a small suburb. But that's a start. And I think it's a better way to vote, and it will get more people voting. Nowadays, a lot of people don't vote. We had a big election in Chicago for mayor. It was a huge election. The television was loaded with campaign ads, and that's good. But only 35 or 38% of the people came out to vote because nine people were running in the first election for the mayor of Chicago, and you only had one vote. And a lot of people felt their one vote wouldn't do any good. But if you had five votes, you have a better chance to influence the election.
Now, just so we're clear, you've said
that all the cities.
Right. But Michael, just so we're clear, because you've said you now have five votes. And I know my conservative listeners, our heads are exploding because they think you're going to get five votes. You really get one vote. You get five choices. You get five swings at the ball before you make your final vote. Right. You're voting once. For your first choice, your second choice, your third choice. There's a process by throwing some of the stuff out to being candidates out and recalculating. But your vote only counts once. Correct?
Yeah, for a state representative.
Yes.
Nowadays, more people are running. More candidates are running for these positions. It used to be only two or three. Now there's five, six, seven, eight people running. For state representative in the primary, Democratic primary, let's say seven, eight people are running for that one position, state representative. Well, you have five votes. You could vote for five of them out of the eight, you see. And it's one position, state representative, but you have five chances at swinging the bat, like you said.
Yeah.
So as more people get accustomed to it and learn how to vote, and they learn how to vote in San Francisco and Minneapolis, they're skilled at it, you know, it'll be more popular. The only downside of, if I have to play devil's advocate is a sense, and what could be negative about ranked choice voting is that some of the elderly people say it's too confusing, it's too complicated, the five votes and how to sort them out. But the real problem is that the ballot is so long. That's a problem, but that's been around for 30, 40 years. You have to vote for 30, 40, 50 candidates in an election for all the various things. That's what the problem. It isn't ranked choice voting. It's a computer system. It's on a computer. But nowadays, more and more people, including the elderly, know how to use computers.
There you go.
Well, if you go to buy food, gasoline, everything, you got to do it on the computer, and they're more accustomed to it. So even the elderly people are accustomed to using a computer and on the election situation.
There you go.
Ranked choice voting.
Nope. Good stuff. Appreciate it.
People, if we institute ranked choice voting, you can.
Yeah. No, I appreciate
the
thoughts.
Just one person. If you don't believe in voting for all five of them.
Gotcha. Gotcha. No, this is good. I mean, I'm with you. I think it's a good idea, Michael.
Louder, I can't hear you.
I think it's a good idea. Keep pushing it out there. And I know there's an organization that we just had a woman on the program just the other day talking about Illinois and ranked choice voting. So I'm right there with you, buddy. I appreciate the call, though. I got to move along. No, look, at the end of the day, I'm all in favor of this. You know, the idea that I'm going to be able to go to the polls and I'll be able to vote my conscience, the first person I want. And if that person doesn't get 50% plus one, my second choice is then tallied. And then if that person doesn't get 50% plus one, then my third, my fourth. And as he said, you know, however many down the line you need to get till you get to 50% plus one, because the goal is to have, you know, someone in that hall of power who has the majority of votes, on their side. And this is where, you know, instant runoff voting, ranked choice voting, whatever you're going to call it, for me has always been a smart policy. So, you know, as Michael said, it's something good to pursue. Let's go to the phones. I got Kurt on line two. Kurt, how you doing, buddy?
Well, thanks, Rick, for taking my call. And I'm glad that you enjoyed your trip in D.C. and also with my brother's Congresswoman, Marcy Kaptur, yesterday.
No, she was fabulous.
Yeah, she's been around for 11 billion years, as far as I can remember.
11, is that an actual number? 11 billion?
It's a Stephanie Miller number, I think.
Oh, okay. I've never heard that before.
Okay. But anywho, you were talking about rich people, and, you know, you were saying, and I was on the phone with your screener when you were talking about this, you were talking about how the rich people in Pennsylvania are saying, oh, jobs are going to be gone because, you know, with all this union jobs and everything, we're going to have to make, you know, pay people more, and that means no more jobs, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you remember, we had, what, a 65% union membership back in the great socialist Republican presidential days of Dwight Eisenhower?
Nope.
Okay. I don't seem to remember wealthy people crying about paying their employees higher union wages. In fact, all they had to do, I mean, my gosh, they had to give up maybe one extra yacht instead of having two, they had one, or instead of two summer homes, they had one. So basically what these people today seem to be doing is they're kind of like poor people, hoarding garbage. They want to just hoard the money for themselves, in a sense.
Yep. There's no surprise in that. You know, if you give them the chance to hoard, they're going to.
Oh, absolutely. But you know, I mean, it just comes down to, you know, if you pay your people a decent wage, that means we're going to have more money coming into the tax system. It comes down to you need to start investing in people like we did after World War II up until Ronald Reagan. And if, as you know, I've actually been reading a book called Over Here, How the GI Bill Transformed the American Dream. For every $1 that you and I as a taxpayer put into that program of the GI Bill, we got a $7 return on that investment. What Republican in this world, well, I shouldn't say this world because we know what kind of Republicans, but I'm saying what person in this world wouldn't want to get a $7 return on their $1 investment?
Clearly somebody who doesn't want government to work. I mean, this is the weird thing. I mean, we've got people who are more than happy to tell us government doesn't work, and then they set out to break things, which is why we were talking about UFOs today, Kurt. We weren't talking about how to make lives better. We're talking about UFOs.
Oh, yeah, but let me tell you this real quick. I was actually born with cataracts, so I was rendered legally blind for life. I grew up in a decent home. You know, my father was a union man. We had great Cadillac insurance, never had to pay a dime for it for 40 years. However, I was able to go through the Bureau of Services for the Visually Impaired in Stark County, Ohio, to have them pay for my college education, my room and board, all that, you know, books, all that stuff,
right,
to go to Kent State. You know, they wouldn't even look at me unless I sat down with a caseworker and said, you need to come up with a long-term plan before we do anything to pay for your schooling, which, by the way, you have to maintain, and I thought this was generous, you have to maintain at least a 2.0 GPA in order for us to pay 100% of your schooling in order for you to take this benefit. I made sure I had a 3.0. But what I'm getting at is my state, my community, they invested in me. And the day that I graduated from college was the day I got the job that I'm in presently. And that was 21, almost 22 years ago. So they invested in me to the point where I'm able to generate tax dollars to put back into my state and my community so that people who may need to benefit from that type of service can do so as well.
Yep, that's how it's supposed to work.
It does work.
Yep.
What's that?
That's how it's supposed to work.
Exactly. That's exactly how it's supposed to work. And I think people kind of forgot about that.
Kurt, I appreciate the call, man. Good story, good stuff. Thanks so much. Look forward to talking to you again
real soon. Thank you.
No, look, I mean, this is how this is supposed to work. I mean, you pay taxes to help the helping hand up. Not the hand out, hand up. And those, I love hearing stories like that. But real quick, check out fairvoteillinois.org for what's going on in the Chicago area and in Illinois around the idea of ranked choice voting and instant runoff voting. We had one of their statewide organizers on the program sometime, you know, when we were at Netroots. We could probably dig that up at some point, but she was fabulous. But fairvoteillinois.org, the website, if you want more information on ranked choice voting in Illinois. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, here on the program, we've been talking about AI for some time, a couple of years now, actually, and the job tsunami loss that we're going to have once it finally takes over. And that report that was published, I think, like 4 or 5 years ago, that said in 20 years, half of the jobs we do or we did back then will be gone, half. If you got some friends who are going, that's probably a little accurate, we should be worried. But I saw the story over at Wired.com. Says that, hey, you know, soldiers, you could be out of work because the AI-powered, totally autonomous future of war is here. Ships without crews, self-directed drone swarms. Evidently, this is what the U.S. Navy is working on. Off-the-shelf robotics and AI for the next conflict. Sounds great. Sounds, well, scary. And here to share some thoughts on just how scary, I've asked Adam Connor to come talk with us. Adam is the Vice President of Technology Policy there at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Adam, thanks for taking time for us.
Always happy to be here.
So let's start with Adam Connor. You're not related to Sarah, are you?
Well, if the machines are asking, I'm definitely not related to Sarah Connor. But no, I'm just a New Mexican here trying to make his way in this world of artificial intelligence.
New Mexico. Okay, before we get into the AI stuff, alien stuff, it was all over today. Republicans crazy on AI, on the UFOs. Which side are you on?
Look, I grew up in New Mexico, and I would just say I've always believed, and it's just everyone else here is kind of finally catching up to what we know is the truth. And I'd also be remiss if I didn't plug the fact that the newest movie, Oppenheimer, is about my hometown. So make sure to stop by your theaters and see it as well.
There you go. No, my kids and I are looking forward to it. It's one of those things where we've said, you know what, we've got to go see that movie. It's 3 hours long, though.
It's quite long.
But let's get to the AI stuff. Obviously, the future of war could possibly be robots and AI, but more importantly to me, the future of work. I mean, that's the scary part.
Absolutely. And you know, I think what's interesting about AI is we're at what I like to call one of those moments where you're kind of not quite sure it's going to fall. And we know things are going to change, and it's just a matter of, do they change as fast as some people say they could, or is it a little more gradual and then bam, you know? And I think one of the things that's really been interesting about the last few months, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this, is that, you know, the technology of automated systems of AI has been kind of steadily advancing in the background for a lot of years. And there's a lot of people who've been talking about it, but it hadn't really broken through to the public. But then, you know, this generative AI, the ChatGPT, kind of comes out, and all of a sudden people kind of get it. And I think one of the reasons they get it so clearly is, you know, all this stuff that's been happening in the past was really kind of machines talking to machines or computers talking to computers. And, you know, this generative AI, it kind of spits out text, or it spits out audio or video, or things that you can just consume with your ears and your eyes. And I think for a lot of people, that was the kind of aha moment that says, oh, okay, like it talks to us, it can talk like us. And that might mean it could replace us in certain kind of ads.
And that's the scary stuff. And this is why, you know, you've got the Writers Guild. Yes. And the SAG-AFTRA folks who are on strike right now, because, you know, one of the scary parts of this, as one of the leaders at the Writers Guild pointed out, or as the Screen Actors Guild pointed out, that the extras can go for a day's work, get $100, and the studio gets to keep their image and likeness and use it, you know, on it in perpetuity for forever and ever and ever. And they get one day's pay.
They get one day's pay, and then
what they can get away with.
one day's pay, and then they have enough extras in the AI machine. At a certain point, there are just no more extras anymore,
right?
And you know, I think that's why the stand the WGA and SAG-AFTRA is taking is so critical right now, because they know if they give it up today, it's never coming back. You know, it is even more so than I think what we've seen disruption in other industries, you know, where maybe a factory physically moves away or something goes away, but the work still is done somewhere else by people. You know, if they give up that ability to kind of do the human work of it, it's never coming back. And I think they're really the kind of canary in the coal mine for what this could mean.
No, and this is the scary part of all this, because, you know, if that report from a couple of years is accurate, half of all the jobs that were done, you know, 4 or 5 years ago will be wiped away by machines or automation or robotics. What are people going to do? Look, I've spent, you know, 35 years in the trucking industry. I know at some point, probably in my lifetime, you know, you're going to see automated trucks, you know, running like trains down the highway with nobody behind the wheel. Maybe in my lifetime at some point, probably a lot sooner than I want. And you've even got people like Tucker Carlson who are coming out and saying that should never happen, because guess what? That's the job most high school educated men, that's what they do. What are you going to do with all these people?
And I think that's a really critical point. You know, if we just let this technology run unchecked, as we know what happens when corporations get a tool that saves them money, they don't plow that money back into hiring more workers or into, you know, they wring every bit of efficiency out of them and then get rid of them. And so, you know, one of the things that we talk about at CAP and that I know the president is also focused on is, you know, this can't just be innovation that destroys jobs, right? That doesn't leave us in a better place. It has to be innovation that we make sure, hopefully, you know, if others will let us, you know, creates good jobs or complements workers instead of just destroying jobs. And that's, I think, really AI is going to impact a lot of different things. You mentioned the future of warfare. It's going to impact all sorts of different things. But I think fundamentally, when it comes to jobs, a question we're really going to have is how much of this can we harness to help workers to make maybe their lives better or safer? And how much of this can we make sure isn't just utilized to destroy livelihoods?
I see it as horribly destructive. I see this as a bigger technological advancement than any in the history of this country. You know, go back to the Industrial Revolution, you know, when we were doing things with horse and buggies to then with machines. I see this as even bigger than that, because at least you could learn a new skill. You could do a, this can eventually, from what I'm being told, and you're the expert in this, Adam, that eventually these computers are going to be able to learn new tasks and they will completely make us, well, worthless.
I don't know about completely worthless, but what is really going to happen that we haven't seen is it's going to disrupt kind of blue collar. It's going to disrupt white collar. Its potential is really to upset, you know, the whole spectrum of jobs. And you could imagine, for instance, you know, jobs that people do today that involve maybe inputting data or doing basic analysis or research or writing TV shows. You know, these are things that at some point they thought being a lawyer would, being a certain kind of doctor, you know, might be protected by these things, and it's going to disrupt them as well. And so I think a question that ends up here is there a way that we can ensure that these kind of complement jobs and are focused in that way? Or if they're going to take jobs, how do we do one of two things? You know, one, make sure that money that is being made isn't just benefiting those who are destroying the jobs. So is there a tax situation on AI that we should be thinking about? And is that money going back into ensuring we build good jobs, maybe through a job guarantee or other things? Like, we're going to have to confront this a lot sooner than I think a lot of people think. I think it is not a silver lining. But, you know, I worked in the social media companies at the beginning of the social media age. We saw how that kind of spread around the world and had a lot of negatives, too. But, you know, that kind of was isolated to your phone or your computer and then kind of spread to the real world. You know, if this is as disruptive to jobs as we hope it is, I think, one, my hope is that people will speak out so policymakers hear them. And then, two, you know, that it happens, if it happens quickly, it happens quickly enough that we can put a stop to it and say this is serious enough. But, you know, that's going to take people taking it seriously in the policymaking world, and that's going to take people speaking up when this is affecting them.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Adam Connor. He's the Vice President of Technology Policy at the Center for American Progress. You want to check out the work that they do, AmericanProgress.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at the work that Adam and the folks over at CAP do. But what do you say to the person like me who believes cat's already out of the bag. You're not putting this genie back in the bottle. These tech companies have invested so much time, energy, money. They've, you know, the politicians seem to be, well, we've got a Republican House that they're talking about UFOs today. We're so far behind on anything that's going to help working people, you know, with a health security, retirement security, wages, you know, education, all of these other problems. This just seems to me that, well, it's too far gone. What ray of hope would you give me?
I would try and give you and your listeners two rays of hope. And I wouldn't say these are promises. You know, this isn't something where we always get the outcomes we want, particularly for working people. But I think there's two things to be hopeful for. One is that this technology is advancing quickly, but it hasn't reached the point of no return yet. It's kind of, it may be there soon, it may be in the next few years, but it's not completely there yet. And we still have a moment to say, we can govern this technology instead of having it govern us. I think the second is that, you know, this isn't going to be a technology that just impacts one sector of the economy or one part of the country. It's going to be widespread enough that regardless of whether you're Democrat or Republican, regardless of kind of, you know, your base for political support, they're going to be impacted. And when everybody is impacted by something, there's sometimes a chance for people to take it seriously and try and address those problems. Now, again, not a promise that they will. But, you know, this isn't going to just be a red state blue thing or a city thing only. You know, this is going to be something that's going to impact a lot of different places and people. And my hope is that that'll allow people to, you know, at least speak up enough that politicians have to fear it and take it seriously.
Now, you said something a moment ago on the tax front. I said about 10 years ago that as this technology, all this different technology keeps rolling out, because I believe we have to tax things. I believe in tax incentives for people to do certain things and taxes to discourage certain behavior. I think there should be a technology tax put in place to help people transition as we lose jobs, truck drivers who are clearly going to be one of the first ones to go. You know, doctors who read x-rays, they're probably going to go at some point. Name the industry. I think there has to be some kind of a technology tax to where the productivity gains are then shared and not hoarded at the top, like most productivity gains right now have been. I'm curious, is there anything that you know of that's banging around in Washington there that might lead us in that direction?
You know, I am not the tax guy, but I will say I know my colleagues on our econ team here at CAP, I've been thinking about this a lot. And I think, you know, you hit it right on the head. In addition to taxing those that are benefiting this and maybe thinking about where we can redirect this to retrain workforce or make sure it's creating good jobs, you know, can you build in incentives? You know, can we give tax breaks to those who incentivize good jobs, that complemented by AI, not just destroying them? I think that's something we're thinking a lot about. And the other is, you know, we have a real monopoly problem in this country. I know you're aware of it. I know your listeners are aware of it. There aren't a lot of choices. There's not a lot of competition. And unfortunately, you know, because of the power big tech has, you know, there's a couple of companies that have all the data and have all the computing power to run the advanced AI. And so they're going to continue to benefit from this, the Googles, the Amazons, and the Microsofts of the world. And so there's also just a question of, in addition to the technology tax you might have mentioned, or can we give taxes, should there just be a monopoly tax, right? You know, is that a place where if you're going to have such a concentrated amount of power and profits that there should be initial tax? We think that's a reasonable thing to be discussing on the table. And I think it's going to seem more and more reasonable if power keeps concentrating in the hands of a couple companies, which, you know, House Republicans may be focused on UFOs and a lot of things I disagree on, but I think they're uncomfortable with a couple of tech companies controlling the world as Democrats are.
Yeah. At the end of the day, though, you know, we working people, you know, every technological change, working people take it on the chin. I keep saying this cannot be another one of those times. Because I fear, and this is where I want to wrap this up, is I fear that this then turns into mass chaos, to violence, to all kind of things. Because when you have people who look, you know, truck driving is, you know, as Tucker Carlson pointed out, the job most high school educated men do. When they are no longer productive and they no longer have the ability to support their families, chaos will ensue. I guarantee it.
I think that's right. I think one of the reasons at CAP we've talked about a job guarantee or other things is because we understand that, you know, if we Inequality is very bad, but inequality paired with lack of employment is really destabilizing, right? And so we have to be aware that this could be another factor that lights the match onto what's already, as you know, not the greatest situation in this country when it comes to how people are feeling. And so I hope, I will say this, you know, I'm not here to give silver linings, but I've worked with a lot of politicians over the years. I know you've talked to a lot of politicians, and, you know, fear motivates them. And I think if they are worried that the technology is taking all the jobs that might, they might get blamed for it, or their constituents, you know, maybe out of work, that fear might motivate them to do something productive. So I'm not a person that says we should only deal with fear, but my hope is it scares them into doing the right thing. And, you know, at least hopefully that can be something we hope for.
Yeah, and it's not just here at home. I mean, we're talking globally. Yeah. This is a problem going to destabilize the globe. And I don't know that we should have that kind of power. I don't know that that should exist. Just my thoughts. But Adam, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts with us. I'm sure this is not going to go away. I'd love to have you back again down the road.
Always happy to join.
Good stuff, Adam Cotter. Appreciate the time, man. Again, this is one of those things where, you know, as I've been saying, you know, we need to get on these politicians early, often, and get it moving in the right direction. But make sure you check out the work that Adam and his crew do over at the Tech Policy Group at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. The website. Gonna take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day that George H.W. Bush signed into law the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA prohibits employment discrimination of people with disabilities and requires public accommodations to be accessible. The passage of the act was the result of years of grassroots organizing by members of the ADA community and their allies. When President Bush signed the law, he said that if he had to thank everyone who had been involved, we'd never get out of here before sunset. The passage of the act had bipartisan support, but many business leaders worried about the ADA's effect, fearing the costs of accessibility accommodations to their bottom lines. While most business leaders did not oppose the act outright, they did push for amendments and concessions to weaken its impact. The business newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, called the act, quote, the Lawyers' Employment Act, warning that a flood of lawsuits on disability issues would harm businesses. In signing the bill, President Bush addressed business leaders specifically. He said, quote, you've called for new sources of workers. Well, many of our fellow citizens with disabilities are unemployed. They want to work, and they can work. And this is a tremendous pool of people. And remember, this is a tremendous pool of people who will bring to jobs diversity, loyalty, proven low turnover rate, and only one request, the chance to prove themselves. The passage of the ADA paved the way for fundamental changes in America's infrastructure, such as accessibility ramps, spots for wheelchairs on buses and subways, and parking accommodations. This was a major step forward, yet more work remains in order to build a society truly accessible to all. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I love the story that the Federal Trade Commission is readying some lawsuits to go after Amazon and to break up Amazon. Again, you know, what's interesting, what Adam brought up, monopoly, a monopoly tax, most absolutely, certainly, we definitely need something like that. Let's go to the phones. We've got Steve from Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you, buddy?
Fine, thank you.
What's on your mind, brother?
Yes, so I wanted to make a couple of points. And I think that the whole technology question, I mean, it depends on what we're talking about. For instance, it can lead to perpetual war. One of the reasons we were able to prosecute the war in Afghanistan for two decades was because technology gave us the capacity to do what's called a force multiplier. And the technology was doing the job that once would have required a lot more troops on the ground. And though I certainly respect the men who lost their lives, those who were injured there fighting that war, the reality is that after 20 years, a little over 2,000 actually were killed in combat. And that means that it's not the kind of thing that people are necessarily in the streets protesting against, unlike the Vietnam War, where you could literally have as many lost in a few days as we would lose in a year in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So what happens when you can prosecute a war across the on the other side of the world without really any Americans? You can fight it from inside a trailer in Virginia using drones and other sorts of things. So that can be a recipe for perpetual war. The other thing is, and you've already addressed it, is the whole economic dimension of this, because during the Industrial Revolution, we saw the same sort of thing. Technology was utilized, but not to the benefit of average people. It gave us the robber barons, these immensely wealthy individuals of the Gilded Age, because productivity skyrocketed, but that didn't filter down to people. It just meant that it was cheaper to produce things using labor, and because technology made it so, and then you could sell that. Now the inevitable result of this formula in the modern age is that sooner or later, who are you going to sell to if nobody is working any longer and everything is run by technology? Somebody's got to make a living in order to buy your stuff. But of course, everybody assumes that somebody else will be working somewhere else. But as long as we automate our industry and utilize technology, if we can just have one guy working somewhere in front of a screen, and we don't need any more workers. Well, yeah, but somebody else has got that idea across other industries as well. And at some point, people who can't work can't buy your things. And, the fact is that we were sold a bill of goods over the last 40 years because the real amount of money that Americans make has been this sort of bait and switch equation, because we went from literally one person working in most homes in a factory job in the 1960s to two people working in the 80s and 90s and up until today. So when we say, this is where the average American, what the average American family is making, yeah, that's because we added 100% more workers.
And I would argue, Steve,
we've got kids.
I would argue that we now need three incomes to have that same standard of living our grandparents' generation did.
Exactly. So I mean, we've got to put in place mechanisms that say that, you didn't get here by yourself. This industry, the Jeff Bezos of the world. Jeff Bezos runs a delivery service, essentially. Amazon doesn't produce things, and it runs based upon the things that we and our parents and our grandparents paid for: airports and roads and other infrastructure that Jeff Bezos utilizes and exploits to get us things much more quickly. Okay, great, but he didn't build those things. A society built those things, and it's time to start taxing these people accordingly in terms of what they benefit from that we paid for.
Yeah. No, I mean, Bezos is a perfect example. The great crime behind his success is that he cheated every state in this country out of sales tax for years. And that's how they grew and got the advantage over everybody else. But you hear, though, Steve, competition, competition. Well, what competition gets us is monopoly. Look at what Amazon's been getting away with.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we could just sort of create a formula, no one's suggesting, at least I'm not. I'm not one of these socialists. I believe that, you can still become a billionaire in America. But you know what? You're going to have to pay a greater percentage of what you make as you move up that scale in terms of wealth. And that money has to filter back into the lives of average people. And you know what? There's a reason why we're starting to discuss in the Western world, instead of a 40-hour work week, maybe 35, maybe 30, because productivity doubled in the last 40 years and then it doubled again. Are we working less? No. So why isn't it why don't we go ahead and create a system in which we say, as productivity goes up, yes, you can have billionaires, and average people get to work a little bit less, spend more time with their families, do other things that we regard as enriching our lives, rather than spending our lives, working day and night until we keel over and die, or until we can no longer work and hope that we can have enough money put away so that we don't die in the streets.
No, I'm right there with you, Steve. Good stuff. Appreciate the thoughts. I look at this, and again, he's not wrong. At the end of the day, we need to have policymakers who are looking towards the future. And, you know, like I said a moment ago, you know, that we've got a potential war machine that's going to be all automated. And he's right. That could be perpetual war on all sides. That could eventually happen here. This is scary technology. It's the kind of thing I don't know that mere mortals should be allowed to, you shouldn't be allowed to touch. Just my thoughts. But, you know, as I'm looking at where we are, and I've said for years, and I've always been the person who says, you know, the tax code is where we create billionaires, and we have. I want to dig up the good socialist president, Dwight Eisenhower, and reenact his tax codes, because it created broad shared prosperity. We can do that again, and we need to do that again, because this technology is going to be really disruptive. And I fear, like all of these, that it's going to be working people who take it on the chin, which is why you're seeing in these labor fights and the Teamsters in their labor fights with freight companies saying, look, you're not going to automate the trucks. You know, with UPS, there was language in there to tap down on the technological. Now, are they putting their members at a disadvantage and their member companies at a disadvantage because you're going to have other companies who just go full tilt towards it? This is where I keep saying, this is why we need to be organizing more. And I'm hoping that as this rolls down, people wake up and in their radical self-interest go, yeah, I do need some protection on the job. I do need a voice that's going to stand up to protect my family and the future. Something that needs to happen. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You got something on your mind, want to hear it. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcasts, you will certainly find ours. Right back after this. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, yesterday we were in Washington, D.C., the big event we had with AFA CWA President Sarah Nelson and Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur. But before the event that we held with those two folks, Sarah Nelson and I and my son Alex were down at the AFL-CIO's headquarters, Black Lives Matter Square Plaza there, with the Writers Guild folks out leafleting, informing people of, you know, the movie that they were going to go in to see. Someone had to write that. Someone's image had to be protected for that. Hey, this is why we're out there. Little informational picket informing folks. Because look, you know, this idea of protecting jobs, this idea of, as we've been talking about, taking on AI and the, well, what is the future of work in this country? Kind of a big thing. But while those are the ones that the Teamsters and the Writers Guild are getting all the attention, there are other folks who are struggling to make inroads as well. And, you know, hotel workers, you know, truck drivers, you name it. And that's why I've asked Mark Kreidler to come talk with us. He's a columnist over at Capital in Maine. You can check out his website, markkreidler.com. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rick.
So I'm looking at this Writers Guild strike, and I'm going, you know, these folks are just fighting for their existence. But in your piece, and you've got a great article, and I hope folks will take a look at, in this piece, you talk about how the executive, an unknown executive, said, you know what? We don't care. We'll starve them out. We'll go as long as we need to go to these people, lose their apartments, lose their savings, lose everything. And I got to tell you, that to me harkened back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s with the folks like Jay Gould. I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. It rang of that for me. I'm curious what you thought.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because you don't often hear a person in that position say the quiet part out loud, even if they weren't saying it for attribution. The news site Deadline, which is, it reports essentially on Hollywood industry stuff, is the place where that story first broke. And they did quote the executive very specifically as saying, look, our plan is to dig in until these writers begin to lose their apartments and lose their homes. Those were the words. You know, there was another executive quoted as saying this stuff had been laid in, this plan had been laid in. long before the strike actually became a thing. And a third was quoted as saying, this is a cruel but necessary tactic. So, yeah, I think you can, even though the alliance of movie and television producers tried to walk that back by saying, hey, these unnamed people don't speak for us. Their actions make it really clear that it's if that isn't the intent, Rick, that's exactly where they're headed, because they are not negotiating. There are no negotiations. There are none scheduled. It's been going on for months now. So it's not really that hard to guess that they're trying to starve out the workers, but that's not new news.
Right.
It's just different because we're talking about Hollywood.
No, what's different here in this, and look, as you've said, this is not new. This is every strike that's ever been. It's who can survive the longest. It's a war of attrition where employers are you know, like, hey, you know, we're going to try and starve you out, and labor's, hey, we're going to last one day longer. The difference here, I think, in this moment is this is, you know, hearkening back to, as I said, you know, the robber baron era, where you had these monopolies who could hold out, and like these big behemoths have the power to withstand these losses, and it's not going to harm them as much as it's going to these workers. And I think that has a lot to say about how weak our labor laws are.
Oh, there's no question about that. You're right. There's kind of two things going on at the same time. And one is, this has been coming on for decades, but, you know, decades of deregulated takeovers and mergers means, you know, more and more power is concentrated in fewer and fewer companies. Again, not new news, but it's hit Hollywood to the point where even studios that you would consider major, like Universal Movie Studios, you know, they're owned by Comcast. They were swallowed up by Comcast, you know, some time ago. Disney took over an entire studio in Hollywood, in addition to everything else that Disney already holds. And so, you know, these, what often happens, and the writers are experiencing this, the actors in SAG-AFTRA, the Actors Guild, are also experiencing this, is you think you're negotiating with, let's say, Hollywood, but you're really negotiating with a New York boardroom or the boardroom of a multinational corporation, wherever it might be headquartered, in which your concern is but a tiny sliver of their corporate concern. There's a really great article, by the way. Jennifer Rubin wrote this in the Washington Post. Jennifer's been a columnist at the Post for a long time, but prior to that, Rick, she was a labor and employment lawyer for a bunch of different Hollywood studios. She's very familiar with the industry in LA. And basically she said, look, in the same sense that some banks were deemed too big to fail, some of these corporations may now be on the brink of being too big to strike. Their pockets are just way too deep. They've got the resources. And, you know, if you're Hollywood, if you're the writers, for example, there's 11,000 writers in the Writers Guild, you just don't take up but a tiny, tiny bit of their bandwidth in terms of what their corporation's trying to do. And where does labor law come in? Well, nowhere, because the labor laws as currently written are, A, 50 years out of date, and B, so weak that they make no difference.
And the fact that, you know, the reality is what these studios want to do is just replace those people as a whole and have computers do their work. And this, again, is, you know, we were just talking a little bit ago about, you know, the tech that's coming and what it's going to do, you know, with us, we, the working people. I look at this strike going on with the Writers Guild and the screen and SAG-AFTRA as the front line of the AI war. This is the first battle in what's going to be the future of work in this country. And we working people had better come around to the idea that we should be on the side of the working people.
Agreed. I think that's something that the writers and particularly actors have had to try to find ways to combat, because the public perception is, you know, you're a rich Hollywood actor. What do I care what, you know, about your labor situation? For the writers in particular, you know, part of what brought them to the brink of a strike and then to a strike is the fact that over the last several years, a number of the studios have said, we're going to use fewer writers. Now we're going to use fewer, now fewer, now fewer. And eventually the idea is that, you know, AI could replicate or amalgamate the work that writers have done for decades, well, from, you know, a century and beyond. And essentially replace the writers outright. Now, with actors, their concern over AI is a little bit more shaded, but it's not hard to understand.
Right.
They stand against the studios being able to film their image and then replicate that image in, you know, a million other uses. And so in both cases, I think we tend to get distracted by the fact that occasionally one of the people speaking about this issue is someone I've seen on TV or that I've seen in a movie. And it lends sort of this weird air of unreality to the whole thing. But they're fighting a ground level battle. It is absolutely, to your point, it's a ground level fight for their continued value as workers, period. And it's really important to keep in mind, and this is true, of course, in Hollywood right now, but it's true, you know, in so many places in our country, that you're dealing again with multinational corporation that doesn't care at all about that, because they're not really in the entertainment business. They're in the stock profit business. And you're just one small part of their overall push to raise that stock price.
Yeah, no, it's all about the dollars and cents. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Mark Kreidler. Mark's a columnist over at Capital & Man. You can check out his website, markkreidler.com. Most certainly you need to check out his most recent article, How Striking Hollywood Creators and Hotel Housekeepers Face the Same Kind of Obstacles. And those obstacles are a behemoth corporation who have extraordinarily deep pockets. Now, in your article, you do talk about the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors and how they're handling their situation. Now, housekeepers, they've got other problems because they can't all withhold their labor because, you know what, they'll all be replaced tomorrow, if I'm getting this right.
Yeah, it's a really interesting twist. So the actors and the writers both just straight up struck. They walked off. Productions have been halted. You know, there's very little Hollywood production even occurring right now, unless it's a straight reality series. And even in that case, a lot of people will not work on those shows. But that's a calculated gamble, especially with the actors. You know, they're sort of in a stronger position because I think they can reasonably say, go ahead, try and make a movie or a TV show without us. The hotel workers are not in that position. They are far more easily replaced. But they do, just like the Writers Guild and SAG-AFTRA, the Actors Guild, they do face corporate behemoths. You might be standing in a picket in front of one hotel near, you know, Los Angeles International Airport. But the truth is, you're trying to battle Hilton or Hyatt or Marriott or one of the private equity firms that is also a multinational that holds several of these properties at once. It's not hard. I've done it. Anyone who wants to and interested enough can do it. You can look on job sites in LA and see that these hotels are already, you know, trying to pre-stack their deck with workers who are ready to come in and take the shifts of anyone who strikes. So instead of going off, you know, en masse, thousands and 15,000 hotel workers all going out at once, they've done these targeted strikes, Rick, where they will hit six or seven hotels for a day or 2 days. They started with a three-day strike in the downtown hotels in LA. Every one of those has the benefit of generating headlines, but also the hotels who are at this point sort of loosely bargaining as a group, about 45 of them are bargaining as an alliance. They don't know what's come. They don't know who's getting struck and when. And it's far more effective, but it's also, as the guild in LA has shared with me, it's kind of their only move. They can't go off the job. They can't just walk off. They'll be replaced. And again, this is where, in a different time, labor law would step in and say, you can't do that.
Right.
But in this time and place, it can be done.
Not only labor law was different, but we were different. And I'm hoping, you know, this is one of those things where I come back to, I'm hoping that we somehow wake up and take back some of the ideas of the old mentality and shut things down. We're across, you know, across industries. And I know secondary boycotts are secondary strikes are illegal and all that stuff. But you know what? In the 1930s, they didn't care about late laws. They shut things down.
Yeah. It's been interesting to see in Los Angeles, especially, there are a number of unions that are cooperating in ways that they've never done before. There are, you know, the hotel workers are hardly the only service employees who are struggling right now. There are workers in theme parks and and you know, Disney and other studio lots who are similarly in tough spots. And they're also negotiating contracts. And for the first time in really anyone's memory in LA, you know, these unions are now sharing their negotiation information. They're sharing the offers they're receiving with other unions. They want each other to know what it is they're being offered, and so that they can't be played off one another.
Right.
That's something I think that's been missing from union organized labor activity for a long, long time. And I think if you look at the sort of roadmap of labor in the United States, you'll see this really disparate collection of mostly smaller groups. There are a few really powerful larger unions. Everybody else is 50,000 or less. And, you know, it makes more sense to pool that power. And that's been a long time coming. So it's really interesting to see how some of the unions in LA have tried to attack this by, at the very least, pooling their information. And by the way, you know, the Writers Guild has been on the picket line alongside the hotel workers and vice versa. SAG-AFTRA members have showed up at the hotel worker strikes and vice versa. So it's a summer of labor unrest in LA, and it may ultimately you know, turn out to really be a summer of solidarity. The question is, what does that lead to? And we just don't know the answer.
No, as I always say, look, you know, we're in a moment right now where, you know, the hope is that we start adopting a striker and we find our way to a picket line. And we get out there, and because, you know, as the old saying goes, the, you know, the larger the picket, the shorter the strike. So the more people who are involved, the more people who are taking part of it, maybe there will be some influence. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, we're in this moment where you've got these behemoth corporations who have such overweighted power. You know, you know, what do people do? How do we push back in a better way, do you think? Are you seeing what they're doing is successful, or is this something legislatively that we've got to eventually come around to, or is this a people thing?
Well, the larger answer, I think, is certainly, you know, takes you to Washington, D.C., and, you know, the will of congressional leaders to enact stronger labor laws, and for that matter, enforce the ones that are already on the books. Short of that, one thing that's interesting about what Hollywood's doing, and the hotel workers have done this pretty effectively too, is, you know, sort of understanding that part of the process, you know, the rules violations part of the process has really got no teeth right now. They're just publicly shaming these companies. They're going right after the CEOs, for example, of the Hollywood studios, repeatedly pointing out their unbelievable compensation packages, repeatedly pointing out what the studios make. The hotel workers in LA have done a really effective job in this same way. Hollywood has the added advantage of being able to say, here's the CEO of Disney, Bob Iger. Here's exactly what he got paid last year. You can publicly embarrass and shame these companies, and some of them, who do to a certain extent rely on people's goodwill for their business, will take note. Whether it affects their behavior at the bargaining table, we don't know yet. But it's one of the only ways, the only tactics that I think has a realistic chance. It's not perfect, and it takes a hell of a lot of effort, and it takes some community support. But it can work.
And it takes communication. You got to get out and you got to talk to other working people. This is not, we can no longer be in a moment of isolated strikes and isolated instances. We've got to bring everyone in. It's got to be a community thing. As I said, you know, like my grandparents' generation, they understood secondary boycotts and secondary strikes. When the company down the street went on strike, everybody on the street went on strike. That's how I think we have to return. But Mark, I appreciate the work. I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues. The piece, How Striking Hollywood Creators and Hotel Housekeepers Face the Same Obstacles, written by Mark Kreidler. We'll get a link out on social media. You can check out his website, markkreidler.com. Mark, thanks so much, buddy. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are
AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Now look, here's the reality. You've got these workers who are on strike, and they're taking on enormous power, and they know it. Look, they know that these studios are out to break them. And this is not unique to them. This is every strike that happens. There's the calculus of how long can the company last, how long can the workforce last, and that's when they start talking again. What happened with the Teamsters and UPS? UPS figured out, hey, they're serious. We could lose billions of dollars if this is a prolonged strike. And the White House stayed out of it. Good on them. Understanding, look, if you're going to be the most pro-union president in our lifetime, you got to go, get out there and fight for yours. Get out there and fight for better wages, hours, conditions. Get out there and do the work. And I think that is that's a testament to the administration. Now, how Wall Street wanted to frame it is wanted to scare everybody. Go, well, it's going to hurt the economy. Well, maybe it will. That's part of this. But it would be UPS would have been the one causing that. Because look, the Teamster said all along, we're willing to negotiate. We're willing to sit down and talk about anything. But at the end of the day, you're an extraordinarily profitable company. You make your profit off the backs of our workers, our members, and their labor. They're getting some of it. And this is, kind of the same fight that's going on with the Writers Guild. Going, look, you keep cutting us, but you're making enormous profits. These streaming services are wildly profitable, making huge money. Their CEOs are pocketing enormous sums. We're just trying to eke out an existence. Now, look, I was in D.C. yesterday with probably, I think there were like 70, 70 folks from the Writers Guild and the SAG-AFTRA folks. Nobody I recognized. Nobody I saw on TV. Nobody go, hey, I know you. None of them. These are people who, they go to work and they do their job and they make enough to exist because they're doing what they're passionate about, what they love to do, and they're eking out an existence. The one person told me, they made like $38,000 a year. And I'm going, how? Well, this is what they've done to us. And when you find out that the vast majority of people who are on strike don't make all that much money, and there's only a handful of people who are making the millions, there's only one Tom Cruise. There are only a handful of people who are in that kind of pay. Everybody else is just trying to make a living. And that's what should come out of this writer's strike and out of this Screen Actors Guild strike, because they are fighting for the extras who make $100 a day. They're fighting for the people who are trying to break into the business. Now, understand, this could be bad for the industry down the road. Not having anyone willing to come and be an extra because, hey, once I sell you my likeness once, you get to use it forever. And I'm working for you literally forever for free. Hello. That's why I say this is the first battle in this war. Now, there are going to be a lot of lawsuits going down the road as AI comes out, and the question is, is Mitt Romney right? Are corporations people? Is AI going to be a person? Will Siri be a person? Will Siri be able to vote at some point? Because evidently we're gonna replace working people with computers. Now, what I find interesting, there's a lawsuit out there, and I think Sarah Silverman and a couple other people are involved in this, who are saying, hey, how can these computers have original thoughts? How can they write these scripts? How can they write articles? How can they do things without stealing from the internet and someone else's intellectual property. And it's an interesting argument, one that I think actually holds some weight. Question is, the Supreme Court, who seems to be the NASCAR of the Chamber of Commerce, funded by all of the big special interests, which way do they go? Which side are they on in this? Me, I'm on the side of the workers in every scenario, because working people have been getting screwed for so long. This is another one of those moments where every person should be saying, yeah, this is a fight we should all be involved in. This is something that we should all be supporting, getting out in the streets and marching with these folks. Because, again, this is one of those weird moments where first they come for the extras. He said nothing. Then they came for the writers, said nothing. Then they came for the actors, said nothing. And eventually all of us are going to be replaced by a computer. Then what? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. You excited about the brave new world?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, some good news. Consumer confidence up everywhere. Everybody's, yeah, things are going well. Stock market's doing well, they say. Inflation's down, wages up, people are buying stuff, things are good, except Biden's, approval rating and the fact that, you know, it's his policies that have made a lot of this possible. It's interesting how it plays out. Interesting. But, you know, in survey after survey, you know, consumer confidence is up. That's a good thing. Maybe it's going to equate into, well, some going, hey, it's those policies that we've been talking about here on the show for, I don't know, 18 years, you know, like reshoring manufacturing, you know, rebuilding our infrastructure, you know, that kind of stuff. Seems like a good idea. Also, it would be great if we had a tax code. If we had a tax code that encouraged work and rewarded work and well, you know, not so much of moving money from one pocket to the other. That's why good news today, a number of folks put forth the Oligarch Act, oppose limitless inequality, growth, and reverse community harms act. That's a mouthful, but it's the Oligarch Act. And it's like, hey, we're going to start taxing some of these people. And here to share some thoughts on the Oligarch Act, I've asked Bob Lord to come talk with us. Bob is a senior advisor on tax policy with the good folks over at the Patriotic Millionaires. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, good to be on.
So walk me through, what is the Oligarch Act and what's it going to do?
The Oligarch Act, I think, Rick, is the first tax bill of its kind. It is directed not so much at raising revenue, although it will raise revenue, but at addressing inequality. And what the Oligarch Act does is it takes the median household wealth, the family in America that's richer than half the population and poorer than the other half, you know, the typical family right in the middle. And it says, if you've got more than 1,000 times that much wealth, which would be over $120 million, you're going to pay 2% tax annually on the amount of wealth over that. And then it says, if you've got over 10,000 times that much wealth, well, then that the amount above 10,000 times is going to be 4%, and 100,000 times wealth, anything over that, 6%. And if you've got 1,000,000 times the wealth of that typical family, then you're going to pay 8% on the amount above 1,000,000 times. And believe it or not, we do have 3 Americans with more than 1,000,000 times the wealth of the typical household.
1,000,000 times. Because I was going to ask, how much is 1,000,000 times the typical? What number is that?
It would be more than $121 billion.
And they would pay 8% tax on that $121 billion dollars
on the amount they have above the 121.
Above, so we're giving them. No, don't worry about that $120 billion. We'll only take that dollar, 8% of that dollar above. I don't know.
Oh yeah, but Rick, the amount in between $12 billion and $120 billion, they'll pay 6% on that. So you know, if this bill's enacted within a decade, we will have a much more equal America. We will restore the distribution of wealth that worked for us so well in the 1950s and 60s.
So you're saying to me, I want to get this right, because I just said that I'd like to dig up Eisenhower and bring back the good socialist president's tax code. You're saying we're getting back there?
Yeah, it'll be a different kind of tax code. We'll be taking the dollars from them in a different way. But because it'll be a wealth tax instead of an income tax, but we'll be getting to about the same result.
So now I can already hear my frustrated millionaires now losing their minds. What, you're raising taxes? You know, when I become a 120 billionaire, I'm not going to want to pay this tax.
Rick, not the ones I work with. I'm with the patriotic millionaires.
Oh, I'm talking about the ones who aren't actually millionaires, the ones who think they're going to win that lottery. The people who told me that we're taxed enough already, that you know, there's too many taxes. We need to tighten the belt and learn to live within our means. Those folks.
We all said that already. We have all these people out here who never, ever will be subject to the estate tax, but they are against the estate tax because they think they're going to be super, super rich one day, and they don't want to have to pay it.
And I've said before, look, I would love to be able to pay the 8% tax that you guys are proposing. I'd love to pay that. That means I'd have $120 billion.
Right.
I mean, I don't know where the objectionable part of this is, because, you know, as my friend Morris Pearl likes to point out, the chairman of your organization, the Patriotic Millionaires, he wants to be able to walk down the street. He doesn't want to have to hire armed guards, and he wants to be able to live, you know, kind of in a country that's free and open to everyone and not have to worry about, you know, I don't know, grandkids getting snatched up in the middle of the night. And I don't disagree with him.
Exactly. Morris says that, you know, he's just as greedy as other millionaires. He's just greedy for a different kind of America, the one where everybody's happy.
So what are the chances of this piece of legislation, which was introduced by a number of House Democrats? I don't see a Republican's name anywhere near this. And I gotta be honest, I find it interesting because I don't see this being objectionable. You have people who have such enormous wealth, you know, and we've got so many needs and a deficit that's so big and debt that's so big that, you know, it seems like, I don't know, the person with all the money should be the one kicking in a little bit.
Well, you know, when we conceived of this proposal about a year ago, and, you know, we started speaking to members of the House members, and, you know, started with Kevin McCarthy, and, you know, went through all the Republicans first. No, we didn't, of course. We didn't go that route. But no, they're not going to be on board. And it's going to take a year, a year and a half or so to kind of socialize this, to get folks used to the idea. And by then, hopefully, we'll have a different Congress come 2025, which, you know, won't have quite as many Republicans, and we can get this thing passed.
Yeah. Now, look, I was seeing some of the numbers that you guys were throwing around. Something like, you know, we've got, I thought we had more than 735 billionaires. I thought we were over 1,000. But you guys say that 735 billionaires saw their collective wealth grow during the pandemic over $4.7 trillion. You know, while the average working family saw their standard of living actually go down. I don't know. I know I've heard people say, you know, all the rich people pay all the taxes. I mean, it seems like they got all the money. I mean, this just seems like something that should really be nonpartisan, that working people should go, look, we need better roads and bridges and schools and healthcare and infrastructure. We need all this stuff. It's got to be paid for. Our work creates this wealth for these folks. Maybe we should be distributing it a little differently. That seems logical to me.
Oh, absolutely. And no, they don't pay all the tax. I mean, you know, Gabriel Zucman and Emmanuel Saez, you know, showed this, how the top 400 taxpayers pay total tax at a lower rate than everybody else.
Yeah, that's what giving people all the money and buying lobbyists and politicians will get you. While, and, as you guys point out, 60% of this country is living paycheck to paycheck.
And it doesn't trickle down, and no, they're not job creators. You know what creates jobs? Consumer demand creates jobs. Money in people's pockets is what creates jobs.
You know, so I look at the fact that, you know, again, you threw out this statistic that we've used a number of times on this show, that, you know, that 40% of the country can't afford a $400 financial emergency, which is just incredible to me. And that a third of the people who get up every day and go to work make less than $15 an hour. And then you go, we've got people who have such unimaginable wealth. The fact that we wouldn't go, hey, maybe kick in a little bit. Now, here's the thing, the question I have for you, because I've said for a number of years that if we had a much higher tax rate, maybe we wouldn't have so many people making less than $15 an hour. Maybe we would have a more equal distribution of wealth, because these wealthy people wouldn't want to pay it to the government. They might pay it out in better wages and you know funding healthcare and funding schools and funding other stuff. Might want to spend it a little bit differently locally. That's the argument that
I mean, like the way it worked in the 50s and 60s?
Yeah, kind of like that.
Right.
No, but I think that's important pointing out.
In inflation adjusted dollars, the highest our minimum wage ever was in 1968, and it's effectively decreased since then.
Yeah, it was what, $1.60 an hour back then?
Well, whatever it was, it's equivalent to, I think, $15 an hour now or something like that. I don't know what the actual number was, but when you adjust for inflation, it's a lot more than the $7.25 an hour minimum wage we have today.
Yeah, no, it was $1.60 an hour back then, and you're right. It was double the current minimum wage, thanks to the fact that we haven't seen an increase. Now, in fact, this month, 14 years ago this month, was the last time we increased the minimum wage, and that was the Bush administration. So we went through the entire 8 years of Obama, the four of Trump, and now the entire Biden term with no increase in the minimum wage. In fact, today you had Bernie Sanders and Bobby Scott put forth the Raise the Wage Act, looking for a $17 an hour minimum wage, which doesn't stand a snowball's chance in passing, because we've got a Republican Party who's hell-bent on doing nothing in the House but talking about UFOs. I guess maybe we'll see a UFO before we see a minimum wage increase.
You don't increase the minimum wage for 14 years. That's, you know, when you take into account inflation, that's about a 40 to 50% pay reduction.
So how do we get this, Bob? How do we get this? You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bob Lord. He's a senior tax advisor with the Patriotic Millionaires. How do we get this moved forward? I talk to individuals all the time. And when you have individual conversations, this is common sense. We have these gazillionaires who've made so much money off the backs of working people, who are not paying the kind of tax rates that past generations have used, and they're hoarding huge amounts of resources that could be used more effectively. How do we get that into the groupthink? Because individually, I've yet to find someone who says, no, it's a good thing to have Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. It's a good thing to have gazillionaires who have more power than governments. How do we get it into that groupthink idea?
Well, you know, the public's attitude has changed, and changed in a good way. Folks overwhelmingly do want to tax these billionaires. It has to change faster, and it has to change more overwhelmingly. And look, this is a start. Things to happen, they have to start somewhere.
Right.
And I think, you know, proposals like this, and this isn't the only one out there. You know, President Biden's billionaire minimum income tax is a huge step in the right direction too. And it's a matter of, you know, the proposals being made and people demanding it. You know, power concedes nothing without a demand. And And we need a country that collectively demands the change. And you know something, Rick? It's got to happen in 2024 because we're running out of time.
No, this to me is a huge election year issue because we've given so much power and control to a handful of people that they control our politics. And there's a Republican Party right now who's not doing anything to help average everyday working people because the pain and the suffering and the misery benefits them. And you know, look, you know, those Democrats, they're not doing their job. But Republicans are the ones gumming up the system. No ideas there whatsoever. So for me, the idea of going back to a tax code that rewards work, but says, no, we're not going to have gazillionaires. No, it's not good. It's not healthy for democracy to have this kind of wealth that isn't being productively used. I just think that's a winning message in 24.
You know something, Rick? It's not even good for the billionaires. That kind of wealth doesn't help people. It makes them unhappy.
I don't know. I think I would be happy if I had $1 billion. I don't know if I would be any happier with 120 than one. But and this is where I guess that question becomes.
What are you going to do with $1 billion that you couldn't do with 50 million?
See, now here's where I'm probably different. I would want a legacy. I would take on an issue like, you know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and I was just talking about this. As a kid, you know, at the end of the month, there was no food in our house. And it wasn't just our house, it was the whole neighborhood. So childhood hunger to me is an important issue. I would be the one who said, you know, I got $1 billion. I'm going to do what I can to ensure that that doesn't happen. And this is the thing that bothers me with a lot of our billionaires. I'm not seeing the kind of, well, benevolence that people believe that they have. I'm not seeing the kind of, you know, and you think of Andrew Carnegie, he built a library system. We have very few. And look, he was a no good for nothing SOB from what a bunch of people have told me. But, you know, his legacy was the library system. Why don't we have billionaires who think in those terms?
They don't. And in fact, they as a percentage of their wealth, they give less than everybody else.
Of course, that's how they got to be billionaires.
These billionaires, I think they average $10 million a year in charitable giving. Now, wow. $10 million is a lot of money, but not when you're worth, you know, multiple billions of dollars. It's a really tiny percentage.
Yeah. So last question I've got for you. How do we get involved? What's the marching order for me? What do I do when I wake up? What's the motivator?
Anything that we can do to make the demand, you know, whether it's, you know, phone calls to representatives and senators, organizing people to rally for this, to vote, putting the question to these politicians at town halls, whatever we can do to make our voices heard, we got to do.
There you go. PatrioticMillionaires.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they're doing. Bob Lord, senior tax advisor there with the Patriotic Millionaires. Bob, always great talking with you, man. Good stuff, as always.
Thanks, Rick. Good to be here.
All right, let's take a quick break. I want to hear your thoughts. Should we be taxing billionaires? Do you agree with Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minnesota, or should that never be a billionaire? I'm in the Jesse camp. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1775. That was the day the United States Post Office was created in Philadelphia under Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was a member of the Second Continental Congress. Among many other distinctions, Ben Franklin was named the nation's first Postmaster General. Franklin received a salary of $1,000, with an additional $340 for a secretary and comptroller. His responsibilities spanned all post offices from Massachusetts to Georgia, and he had the authority to hire additional postmasters measures as necessary. Previously, in 1753, Benjamin Franklin helped lead the postal service in the colonies. He made numerous improvements in the mail system, including setting up new, more efficient routes. He had also been able to cut delivery time in half between Philadelphia and New York by having weekly mail wagons travel both day and night via relay teams. In 1774, the British fired Franklin from his postmaster job because of his revolutionary activities. There have been postal unions dating back to the 19th century. Those early unions had essentially no bargaining rights. They existed largely as lobbying organizations that otherwise would have no say about their working conditions. Wage increases depended on the whim of Congress. On March 18, 1970, thousands of New York City postal workers walked off the job in protest. They were joined in the streets by 200,000 others in 30 major cities. Mail service ground to a halt, and the plight of postal workers was brought to the public's attention. The strike was soon settled, with Congress approving a 6% wage increase. The strike served as an impetus for the enactment of the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970, which granted unions the right to negotiate with management over their wages, benefits, and working conditions.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Now, look, you know, going back to this tax thing, you know, the reality is, and some of the numbers that that Bob's organization put out, when you look at the fact that, you know, like they said, 60% of the people in this country are living hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck. The money comes in, money goes out. It never makes it to the next week. 40% of people can't come up with $400. And interestingly enough, I have a friend who's a homeless advocate. And she says, look, you know, one of the main reasons for homelessness, and it's mind-blowing when you stop and think about it. One of the main reasons people are homeless, car repairs. I mean, stop, let that sink in for a second. Your car breaks down. You got to come up with $400 or $500 to get the car fixed. You don't have it. You don't have a credit card, you know, the elasticity of a credit card, or maybe you're maxed out, whatever. You can't get the car fixed. So then what happens? Well, you can't get to work because public transportation in this country sucks. So now you lose your job. Now you lose your job. You got no money. Now you end up losing the place where you live. And because you've gotten thrown out of one place, that means you're probably not getting another because, one, you don't have any money. So just something simple like, you know, the alternator went, could lead to mass chaos. And that has everything to do with the fact that a lot of the jobs in this country, sorry, just don't pay. So when I see, you know, these right-wing think tanks saying, oh my gosh, they're talking about raising the minimum wage, that's going to cost 130,000 jobs. Is it? And where are you getting, which orifice did you pull that number out of? I think I have an idea. Because what we know, when you raise the minimum wage, there's actually an increase, very slight, but an increase in jobs. And why is that? Well, that's because more people have money in their pocket to spend locally. And that is the engine, as Bob Lord pointed out, that's the engine for an economy. People with disposable income spending money on, you know, stuff that they need. Like a new alternator. The fact that you have, as I said, a third of the people in this country working for less than $15 an hour, that's a problem with distribution of wealth. Now, understand, as we talked about, the minimum wage back in the late 60s was $1.60 an hour, or in today's terms, twice what our minimum wage is, which meant that everybody across the board was at least making. Now, again, the minimum wage does leave out a lot of people, and we can get into that argument if we have to. But for the mass of people, especially the folks making minimum wage, it was something you could almost live on. Something you could, have an apartment, drive a crummy car, pay your college tuition on, and go to school. No people who have done it. And what happens is when we have this kind of mass inequality like we're suffering through right now, social mobility goes down. You have, you know, other outcomes of poor social outcomes. You have lower life expectancy. You've got all kinds of more mental illness, all kinds of negatives. And as Bob said, you know, the reality is rich people aren't any happier. Are you happier with $120 billion than you were with $119 billion? Well, maybe we should ask Elon Musk, who evidently, Mr. Free Speech, decided that he was going to ban an ad launched by the folks over at the Progress Action Fund. Evidently, this it's called Keep Republicans Out of Your Bedroom. This was the name of the ad. And evidently, it's been banned on X. It's no longer Twitter. It's now X. And this is one of those moments where you go, yeah, I know Elon killed Twitter, $44 billion. It's done. It's now X, which, you know, we can ridicule all we want. But the fact of the matter is he took what was a social media platform that a lot of left and center left groups, you know, had some clout in, and completely wiped it away, and has turned it into, you know, basically Gab or Parler or a right wing cesspool. Congratulations. He did exactly what he wanted to do, because what, $44 billion, you know, of lost money doesn't mean anything to him. This not good for democracy. And look, you know, what X is doing is silencing people that he doesn't agree with. Now, this is a guy who told you he believes in free speech. This is a guy who said, I bought Twitter because free speech. Silencing free speech. Now, look, I you know, if you want to have that argument, it's about free speech. I know there are some purists. Great, fine, do that. But don't be the hypocrite of it, which is what Musk is. Because at the end of the day, he's a dictator. And I would argue not a benevolent one. Ask his workers. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You'll get ours. Thoughts, questions, comments, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.